Word of Mouth Wednesday. Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. This is December the 8th, 2010. It's a legendary day, major day, and Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. We've got our Caught in the Act special. That's right. Tonight we're going to be going through what the Ombudsman of Ontario revealed yesterday. We've got audio from the House of Commons, from the House of Parliament, the Ontario Legislature, the Ombudsman report released on the G20. Walking into a trap is what it was known as. And we've got some audio from a few of the people that spoke after Andre Morant made his remarks, NDP leader Andrea Horwath, PC leader Tim Hudak, and then an interview with the one protester that was outside of Queen's Park yesterday protesting the police involvement, Jefferson Rebu. Plus, we're trying to line up Robin Yetzo's interview here with somebody that knows about the Cancun, all about the Cancun Climate Conference, and actually joining us back in the studio, in the booth. We got Robin Yetzo is back here today. Word up.
Hey, Daniel.
Yo, Robin,
see,
which are you on
there? Oh, there we go.
Yeah, on that one.
Hey, Daniel.
Nice.
Yeah, we're trying to get an interview with Virginie Lambert-Ferry. She is in Cancun for the last days of the Climate Conference. And this is where world leaders are trying to hammer out a deal to basically save the planet from climate change. There's only a few days left in this conference, and we're going to try to connect with her to find out what's going on in terms of a deal to stop climate change on this planet. So, in the meantime, we'll give it over to you, Daniel, so you know you can continue with the show.
Word. Thanks a lot, Robin. So we'll try to get that interview lined up for a bit later on. We've got a full show. We got the top watchdog of Ontario, the watchdog report, the words on the G20, and the secret law. And let me tell you, it's something that's definitely a hard hitting bit of audio we're going to be playing here in a minute. Maybe first, we'll just go with a, you know what? I think maybe we should just start it off, with the Ombudsman himself. Here we got this all took place yesterday, which would have been Tuesday, December the 7th. And it was a major report, released. It was about a bit more than 100 pages, and it's got full of information. One new thing that the Ombudsman mentioned that's going on with this report that hasn't been done in an Ombudsman investigation before has been the social media aspect of it. And that even includes YouTube videos that they've gone through. They've gone through Facebook, Twitter. They've gone through a whole lot of evidence, I guess, through these blogs and, you know, the words and videos and pictures that people have posted. So that was an interesting one. And, you know, there was two people charged under the Public Works Protection Act, but you actually go through the massive what they got, and it was actually, there's so much trouble with just people being searched and stopped and searched, you know, never charged with anything. Only two people are ever charged in her, but thousands searched and whatnot. Well, why don't we just, I'll just play this one, and get Robin's interview guest up next, but here's the hard-hitting words from the Ontario Ombudsman, Andre Morant, on the G20. Word up.
The idea was that this new regulation would help the police close the gaps. Some people in the ministry were rightly concerned about the optics of using wartime legislation, but others saw the regulation as mere technicality. So the decision was made not to publicize it. Instead, they quietly handed the police extravagant, sweeping powers under 71-year-old law. Powers that would almost certainly be illegal and unconstitutional under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Little did they realize that once this powerful weapon was unleashed, it would be almost impossible to control. Reviving this dormant piece of legislation coupled with the adoption of the regulation, created a legal landscape where people were detained by the police and compelled to identify themselves, answer questions, and submit to warrantless searches, even if they simply wanted to walk away. Responsible protesters and civil rights groups who took the trouble to educate themselves about their rights prior to the G20 had no way of knowing they were literally walking into a trap. They were literally caught in the act, an act of public entrapment. The Public Works Protection Act and its pernicious regulatory offspring. Many of you will remember the added confusion when the Toronto Police Chief and some of his officers described the regulation as, quote, a 5-meter rule. Some of you reported about it. But there was no 5-meter rule. And even when this was corrected, police continued to arrest and search people well beyond the security zone. Our report is full of stories from people who encountered this treatment, as well as photos that capture the unforgettable scene of those 2 days. Our investigation revealed some very troubling facts about the ministry's conduct in sponsoring this regulation and failing to publicize it. It was unreasonable and grossly unfair. I'm convinced that the regulation was necessary and probably illegal. I've also raised serious questions about the Public Works Protection Act, a law that no other province has. This is why my main recommendation to the ministry is that it revise and consider replacing the act, particularly in terms of the powers it confers on the police, and that it ensure that such regulations are always clearly communicated to the public in the future. I'm very pleased that the ministry has agreed to all my recommendations. And I look forward to seeing the results, the Honorable Roy McMurtry's review of the act. Regulation 233, it's ground zero, was in Chief Blair's office. No other police agency wanted anything to do with this regulation. It was sold to the province, and the province implemented it. And many of the other law enforcement partners learned about the existence of this regulation and then the misspoken application of this regulation the very time you and I learned about it when it was reported in the media. The technical aspects of Regulation 233 was to close the loop on the fence, the infamous fence in downtown Toronto. But that, to me, was the smallest effect of that regulation. The most significant effect of Regulation 233 was that it revived a piece of wartime legislation that was passed in 1939 to protect infrastructure in Ontario from the enemies of war. And the elephant in the room at all times in the discussion of law enforcement surrounding this event is, was it really required to enact a wartime piece of legislation that gave phenomenal powers to the police and was of questionable legality? Now, we did offer the chief two opportunities. I believe the letter's been distributed to you on August 5th. We wanted, first of all, the officers who were shown in various photos and video footage to come forward and explain what their understanding was of this regulation that was passed. And that was refused. The chief refused us access to those officers. And then again, subsequently on August 26, we asked the chief to interview him because we wanted to know what his understanding was of this regulation and what instructions he passed on to the force, the Toronto Police Service. And again, we refused cooperation. You know, our role here is not like the SIU. We're not here to lay criminal charges or to investigate the criminal actions of the police. We're here to get an explanation. An explanation because this is a matter of great interest. And when the chief described this as the 5-meter rule, that bewildered you. It bewildered me. If any, there was any description that was more appropriate than the 5-meter rule, however erroneous, was to call it the 5-kilometer rule. Because people were in Arlington Gardens, 2 kilometers away, having their knapsacks examined and searched by the police. We encountered a woman who was leaving the Queen's Quay Loblaws, and she was getting her groceries examined by the police, even though she was hundreds of meters from the fence. And this happened throughout Toronto without any legal justification. You got to be clear, police can ask whatever questions they want. You can ask people, what is your name? Please identify yourself. But when we saw three police officers stopping an individual on a bike and using the authority of the Public Works Act to force someone to identify themselves and be searched, that is illegal behavior. You can't do that. There's no legal basis for the police to do that. Unless, of course, they're relying on the Public Works Protection Act. There are common law authorities where the police can, if they have reasonable grounds to believe you committed an offense, to search you. There's common law authority to protect international dignitaries within reason. There's no common law authority that I'm aware of that entitles the police to exercise prophylactic scan detention. And that's what they were doing. There was a premeditated, conscious, planned decision not to announce the existence of the regulation. You know, the government, the ministry had its website. City of Toronto had a website. The Integrated Security Unit had websites. Had ads in the paper warning about street closures, things that were going to happen. Was there any, at one point, mention that the police had a right, according to a 1939 law, to arbitrarily detain citizens kilometers away from the fence, to search their belongings, to force them to identify themselves? No, at any time there was not. And that was a conscious, premeditated decision by the authorities. Apart from a coterie of senior officials in government and the Toronto Police Service, no one else was aware of the existence of this regulation or the fact that they would trigger what amounted to martial law in downtown Toronto.
How much cooperation did you get from Toronto Police Service?
Zero. I mean, a zero cooperation, which is rather astounding. I'm not conducting criminal investigation. I could have subpoenaed Chief Blair. The ability under my act to subpoena people and to force them to give testimony under oath. Now, fortunately, this case, it was not necessary to go down that route because we had access and full cooperation by the provincial ministry, who was able to provide us the letters and communication they had with Chief Blair. So Chief Blair's participation was not required in the end. Really, we were able to get the job done without him. It's unfortunate, though, that we weren't able to interview those officers that were captured on video and still images because we wanted to know who had briefed them about their authority. But again, we found the answers to that through the ministry and the passage of a regulation under the 1939 Act. As I said, it's a relic. It's a civil rights landmine from World War II that was never repealed. It exists today. And it designates as public works, public buildings, public parks, streets, and highways. So theoretically today, the police could, on any of those areas, start saying, I'm enforcing the 1939 Public Works Protection Act. They didn't need the fence to do that. But people know very well, anyone who has a high school grade law education knows very well that the police do not or cannot arbitrarily detain people in Canada to ask for their ID. So people just ignore the 1939 Act, except here when Chief Blair petitioned the government.
Was this sort of some sort of attack on our democracy, or was this some kind of madness that overtook the people in a position of power in the face of this kind of international pressure?
We have the means as a society to bring proper law and order. Many observers will tell you, legal experts, that you didn't really require any additional authority, that the common law authority and existing law was sufficient. But suppose the government disagreed. It had the option. The option was to pass a proper piece of legislation that protects people, not rely on a 1939 piece of legislation protecting infrastructure. In the 1970s, when Prime Minister Trudeau invoked the War Measures Act, he presented it in Parliament. There was a debate. Rightly or wrongly, it passed, and it led to the arrest of just under 500 people with about 60 charges. Fast forward 2010, we bring back to life a 1939 act that leads to the arrest of over 1,000 people with 99 charges outstanding. To me, that's disturbing. And for the citizens of Toronto, the days up to and including the weekend of the G20, we'll live in infamy as a time period where martial law set in the city of Toronto, leading to the most massive compromise of civil liberties in Canadian history. And we can never let that happen again.
We had enough of this G20. We had enough of Dalton. We had enough of Harper. Time to get rid of him. What the hell is this country coming to? We let the select few act like we dumb fools. 1.3 bill to control the back talk, then justify the actions of spending because of black bloc. Nah, the people ain't feeling that here. HST G20 secret laws all this year. I think it's time we let them know that they tactics ain't working. No more wool over the eyes of the class that are working. The media only showing what they want us to see. So we have to press for the truth where the knowledge is free. Grab your copies of basics, drop a toonie for fight back. Papers of the people, it's our people that write that. This ain't 86, Fort Pickens, Geronimo. We need to expose the truth, 2010 to Guantanamo. Abuse of power situations and the torture plenty. So come together and your huff G20. We need to take the city back, they don't treat us as equal. Enough of this issue, all power to the people. They be the protesters singing no Canada, our home and native land, but they really no fan of us. They handle us in an attempt to dismantle us. No cops researching women, probably got it on camera. Secret laws passed by Dalton, villainous ways. They increase police presence, it's a military state. Public Works Protection Act is a joke. Empowers cops and render cops to harass our working folk. Our city's cowards.
Word up, Public Works Protection Act, a joke? Well, that's what 4D is talking about. That was just 4D there on the with the G20, Whose Streets Are Streets. And then also, you just heard before that, Andre Morin, the Ontario Ombudsman, speaking about the G20 caught in the act. And we're going to have some more responses. We're going to have some political responses, some protester responses from the words of the Ontario Ombudsman coming on later on in the show. But we got Robin Yetto's guest here on the phone, and Robin Yetto is back in the studio. We got the climate change Cancun topic. I'll throw it to Robin right here.
Hello, 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 and welcome. Welcome. This is great. Okay, so we're going to be talking about the Cancun Climate Conference. These are the last days of the conference. The high-level talks began in Cancun on Tuesday. That's when world leaders were arriving, including our own Canadian world leaders. Well, maybe not world leaders, but national and provincial leaders who went down to Cancun. And on the line tonight, we have Virginie Lambert-Ferry. She is a Greenpeace climate and energy campaigner who is inside the conference center with these world leaders. She is following the Canadian negotiators and their positions. Welcome, Virginie.
Hi.
Virginie, tell us what's going on. Give us an update. You've been there since November 29th, I think. And tell us what's going on now during these high-level talks.
Well, it's kind of difficult, actually, to understand what's going on, as we don't have all the details of what countries are actually trying to trade off, and in order to reach a compromise at the end of this conference. Until now, some countries like revealed their position regarding, for example, the future of the Kyoto Protocol, like Japan, who talked very vocally against a second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. It means it's actually very bad news for us, as we are here in Cancun to actually find a way and to organize and to settle and establish a second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, so that developed countries will be bounded by some targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we know that Canada is actually hiding behind Japan on this topic, and Russia also. So this is the major thing that has been happening in the last 10 days, and this is an important breakthrough, and it's difficult to know what actually we're going to have at the end of the conference now, because it's a big threat to the UN process, so we still have to figure out.
Hello, Virginie. We're on Skype right now, so I'm not sure if it helped us out a bit, but are you still there, Virginie?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. Virginie, the latest news that's coming out here in the papers is about Minister John Baird and his not wanting to endorse an extension of the Kyoto Protocol. And how has this changed the position of Canada since Copenhagen? Its refusal to endorse an extension of the Kyoto Protocol. Has this made Canada an active agent in terms of blocking any progress towards climate change, solutions to climate change?
Well, I don't know if you could hear me what I was saying, that because we're on Skype here, right, Robin? So the contact can have been cut between when I was saying that. But like, since it's the position of Canada is difficult to actually understand and track in these negotiations, because, for example, Japan is speaking vocally against the Kyoto second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, which is not the case for Canada, which doesn't mean they are for a second commitment of the Kyoto Protocol. So the position in these negotiations is actually that we know that they are actively working in the corridors to block progress on these topics, but they don't vocal about it, so that we cannot actually blame them directly. So they currently have hiding behind Japan, who's actually vocal on this topic.
Okay, so
it's a bit tricky. This position hasn't been changing so much since Copenhagen. But Canada doesn't want to be vocal too much about it, so that we cannot blame them directly, but nobody's very...
So, Virginie, sorry for interrupting you. Sorry for interrupting you, but our Skype connection is going on echoes. But you were saying that Canada is hiding behind Japan, that is actively, you know, rejecting the Kyoto Protocol, and so that is not different than their position in Copenhagen. There's also news coming out that saying that the environment minister Baird says that it wants China to step up, and it wants all countries around the world to have a sort of the same exact position when it comes to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So how's that playing out in Cancun?
Well, Canada's repeating what we've been saying. They want everybody in a single treaty, and they don't want to accept that countries like Canada have historical responsibilities for climate change. And they want to put everybody in the same basket, like the U.S., India, but these countries don't have the same responsibilities in terms of releasing greenhouse gas emissions in the past, since the Industrial Revolution. The first thing is that Minister Baird doesn't quite get it about the historical responsibility and about common but differentiated responsibilities. And these words, like common but differentiated responsibilities, actually the words were written in the text of the Convention of Climate Change, which has been signed, you know, by Canada, which is so it's a bit of a problem. And as Greenpeace, we're not saying that China and big emitters in the developing countries should not be.
Hey, Virginie, we just lost
that,
you there. Yeah.
And that doesn't have other industrialized countries.
Right. If you could just repeat that again about China and Greenpeace's position on on that?
Sure, sure. And is bad. I'm saying that we're saying that Greenpeace is not saying that developing countries should not be committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We're saying that the first one who have to do it is actually industrialized countries like Canada, because they're historically responsible for climate change.
Yeah. And I just wanted to let you know that this Tuesday, the Federal Environment Commissioner actually criticized the Harper government's efforts to curb climate change and said their efforts are entirely insufficient. And that's also, you know, going along with what's happening in Cancun. Just to let you know, that bit of news that happened this yesterday, actually.
Yeah.
This was the federal.
You're right. It's not.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's right. You're right. I mean, it's not. It's not only environmentalists who are saying it, right? This is the environment commissioner who's saying that, like, we're lacking on climate change. You know.
That's
we're
right.
Lacking on climate change. We don't have the data on climate change that would help Canada to actually adapt to climate change. It's a real problem. It means that there's no leadership in Canada regarding climate change. Climate change is not something that is interesting for the Canadian government, and it's actually very depressing, because it means that, you know, like, some external parties are actually saying, you know, Canada is not doing its fair share.
And in terms of coming up with something in Cancun, when you have countries like Japan, Canada, you know, not wanting to renew the Kyoto Protocol, do you know what's happening with the other countries in terms of the southern countries? Are they creating their own position in terms of what they want? And how different are the positions of industrialized northern countries like Canada from those positions, from the countries of the south?
Well, there's a division between north and south, for sure, in these negotiations. But there's also a difference. Sorry, there's an echo here. There's also a big difference within developing countries, like with the big emitters and like China and India, compared to small island states, for example, who are very vulnerable to climate change and who actually are fighting for their lives in these negotiations. In terms of what are they looking for? I could take an example. Currently in Cancun, what's happening is, like, a lot of countries, like African countries, less developed countries, small island states, are actually fighting on a topic which is called vulnerability. They because they're fighting for their life, and they know that they need money to adapt to climate change. There's sort of a battle within these countries to know, to determine who is the most vulnerable, and then who would deserve more money than the others. So this is a bit of what's happening on the ground, and it's understandable. But at the same time, these countries should be aware that this is not exactly the topic today. Like, we need to secure the money for developing countries within the Green Fund. This money would come from developed countries so that they could help developing countries to adapt to climate change and to create and build a low-carbon economy in their countries. There's some movement on this issue, which is called the climate finance issue. But still, until now, we haven't seen any compromise in the text. And the texts which are on the table currently reflect the positions of the countries, of some of different countries, but it's not a text of compromise. So still a lot of compromise have to be made here. We still have 3 days to do it. And so the ministers who are here in Cancun have a lot of job, because you know, like, their negotiators before ministers came in town haven't been able to find a compromise on the text.
So, Virginie, with just 3 days,
there's still a lot to expect in these negotiations. But progress and compromise are being to make. Here.
So, with just 3 days left, Virginie, what is what seems to be the most realistic in terms of some kind of agreement being brought out? What seems to be some points, at least, of agreement of all of these countries? What do you think, from what you've seen, from what you've heard, what will be at least one agreement that all of these heads of state can agree to? What is one of just one? Can you give me one example of what they are agreeing to?
No, I can't. Unfortunately, I can't, because everything is still on the table. And how is our saying? There's no compromise made on any topic currently.
How is that different from Copenhagen, Virginie?
Oh, because we haven't, you know, it's not, I mean, like, we still have 3 more days. So, there's, like, we have 3 more days to find an agreement, at least on some topic. So we can't, like...
It's incredible.
This is not a Copenhagen summit. This is totally different. The expectations are not that high. We are not asking for the same thing that we were asking in Copenhagen, because we know that that countries were not in capacity to deliver that in Cancun. So we are actually looking for some steps forward in order to get a global deal next year. But on this progress, on these building blocks where we need to see some progress, until now, we haven't been going back, but we haven't made any progress neither. So it's neither good news, neither bad news, but time is running out.
Time is running out. Just 3 days left. The expectations were a lot lower. The demands were maybe not as, you know, intense. And yet maybe some, you know, steps to build some kind of an agreement. And even those steps haven't been taken, with just 3 days left in Cancun. Is there anything coming up in the next 3 days that you think will, you know, be a sort of a game changer?
Well, just like this afternoon happened, like Spain actually announced that they were supporting the European Union target to be increased from 20% to 30%. Below 1990 levels by 2020. It's an important step within the European Union. Hopefully, it will move the European Union, which is one of the leaders in this conference. But in Cancun, the European Union hasn't been moving that much. And we're expecting a lot from the European Union to sort of like put some step forward in order to take the others and to bring this leadership that is needed into this conference, mm-hmm. and maybe others will then take further steps. So maybe the European Union can still move forward. It's difficult to know, but Spain made a great commitment today, and it's important to mention it.
Okay, Spain. So Spain, leader from Europe, in at least in renewable energy anyhow. I suppose that's why they're, you know, taking the lead on in Cancun, which is great. So for the last question, Virginie, the next World Climate Conference, tell me about if we have no deal at all in Cancun, what does this mean? And what does this mean, first of all, to the planet? And second of all, what will this mean in the next climate conference, which happens in Johannesburg, right, in South Africa next year?
Well, if there's no agreement, it's difficult to predict. You know, like, we can get no agreement, we can get an agreement which is not the one we wanted, so it's difficult to predict for the moment. But it would be definitely a failure of the UN process at some point, a failure of the multilateralism of the United Nations process. The problem with that is that the United Nations process is still the best one, is the best process to go through, because it's the most democratic one. Like, we can put this, like, if there was a failure of this conference, we would have to go to other forums to discuss these topics. But actually, it's not because the UN process is slow that it's not a good one. It's because there's a lack of political will of certain countries like Canada that we are in this situation. It's not because the UN process is not working well. it's become Canada, because Canada, the U.S., are not willing to take real actions. But the rest of the world, the vast majority of the world, is actually willing to take some action to fight climate change. So I think we can get a deal. For example, even if the U.S. is not on the board, on the side, it was the case for the Kyoto Protocol. We still can make another protocol without the U.S. So let's figure out what's going to be the real, you know, and the final agreement in Cancun. And hopefully that's not going to be the failure that you were mentioning in Copenhagen. And I don't think it can be. It's going to be a step towards another agreement, and maybe a very tiny step, maybe a big step. It's difficult to know now.
Virginie, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Virginie Lambert-Ferry. She is a climate and energy campaigner from Greenpeace. She is on the ground in Cancun. She is at the inside the conference center. She's following the high-level talks of the Canadian representatives there, Federal Environment Minister John Baird, and of course other ministers have went as well, like Jean Charest from Quebec, and have joined world leaders to try to hammer out a deal to stop climate change, which it seems pretty evident is happening. Yes, that's the Cancun Climate Conference that is taking place. It started on November 29th, and it ends this Friday, December 10th. Over to you, Daniel.
Word up. Yeah, Word of Mouth Wednesday. We're here in Toronto, but we're going worldwide. This is a track from Melbourne, Australia. This is Juan Six, Mr. Misinformation, Pan Productions. Word up, Juan Six.
You are what you believe. Yo. Don't get misled. What's a name, what's a label, what's a state of mind? State of being or state of the state that you stay in? Status of the day-to-day base where you're stationed, all the features of the deity you place all your faith in. Will it change when it all turns around? Everything you know is nowhere to be found. When Mr. Misinformation takes over your town, and knowledge becomes the power that'll put you in the ground. Tell me, what do you know, and how willing are you to be concerned by that which you don't? An accurate quote, if you have to adapt to a zone that isn't naturally yours and have to manage accordingly. Course it seems harder in the grander scheme of holding on to a dream when reality is Vaseline. Get a grip or let it slip, on with the second tick. If you never lose, you'll never know what progression is. From obsession comes negligence, pressure brings excellence. Every day is exactly the same thing while you step on the precipice, seat to the edge and realize only gravity is waiting. And rock bottom's got problems, he's trying to get on top of it before his time's up. Cause forever's never promised, and the soul solace offered is hoping your body doesn't go rotten before your mind does. So what's your name, what's your label, what's your state of mind? State of being or state of the state that you stay in? Status of the day-to-day base where you're stationed, all the features of the deity you place all your faith in. Will it change when it all turns around? Everything you know is nowhere to be found. When Mr. Misinformation takes over your town, and knowledge becomes the power that'll put you in the ground. You got to get up, get out and get something, then get snowed under.
Quantitative easing.
Understand, cause you have to lose control of what you hold in your hand before you can build your soul and learn to grow as a man. And I never stood in line for inheritance. My sole possession is the journal my 2 feet wrote in the sand. Everything that I've endeavored to get, that I've actually got evidence. There's a goal in the plan.
Foundation.
The quest for the synthetic roaming the land, searching for a pot of gold where no rainbows end, where insane old men will take your ends, imposing a tax as a means to fund global attacks. So tell me what
that.
Babies born in war zones getting killed before they learn to adapt. Only now have we determined the fact it only takes the world 2 bad presidential terms to collapse alongside the economy. Force their democracy while mind, body and spirits controlled by oligopolies who burn the crops and rot the cream. Market glossy seems to skinny body teens who hardly got a steam. Getting caught up in a scene like that's hot but it's scorching, cause the world climate is no longer what it's been. It seems the rainy days are coming few and far between, so it's fair to blame the stoners for consuming all the green. Tumors and melanomas develop behind the screens. Go out to get tanned up, go back home with cancer if you're making it all. Cause the cops don't say hands up, they pepper spray and let the metal spray till the mag's done. So that's another queen outliving her grandson. Nobody left to help her pick her shopping bags up. Going through a hell that she'll never come back.
back from, cause all she has is questions, but no one has an answer to. What's your name, what's your label, what's your state of mind, state of being, a state of the state that you status of the day-to-day base, where you're stationed, all the features of the deity you place all your faith in. Will it change when it all turns around? Everything you know's nowhere to be found. When Mr. Misinformation takes over your town and knowledge becomes the power that'll put you in the ground, what the
tarp
do you know?
Word of Mouth Wednesday. Shoutouts to all the people doing hip-hop worldwide, and especially to the people down under, Melbourne, Australia, representing for Melbourne, the good people of Australia, and the Pang Productions of Vic Spitters. 1-6, you just heard there. Mr. Misinformation was the track. And that was a bit cleaned. You heard a few snippets in there just to clean up the track a bit, take out the swearing, because, you know, we got regulations here. We're governed here on CKLN. We're governed by the CRTC, and that's actually what's going on right now. I actually these days, because earlier today I was over near the airport at the DoubleTree by Hilton, where the CRTC hearing is taking place on CKLN. And so I've been all over the city today. Now I'm downtown now. And but earlier today, and they did mention that they're going to have the hearing's going to extend into tomorrow, most likely. So if you could make it out to near the airport, Dixon Road, you can find the DoubleTree by Hilton, or you can listen to it. You can listen to the hearing streaming on the CRTC website, crtc.gc.ca. CKLN, word up. Find out what's going on in your community radio station. And what's going on with the regulations, the Board of Canada governing these airwaves that we're just getting into, one of the most hard-hitting topics we've talked about, caught in the act. The G20 Toronto has been caught. We finally have a over 100-page document documenting the horror stories of the G20. Let me draw your attention to page 44 of Andre Moran, the Ombudsman of Ontario's report released yesterday. The war ends, but martial law still lingers. When the war ended in 1945, the nation returned to a peaceful existence. The Public's Work Protection Act lingered, a remnant of a world in conflict. So this Public's Work Protection Act was from World War II, first enacted, and it still lingers, with the exception of some relatively minor amendments, including a 1990 when the fine levy was increased from $500. Other than that, the act has remained largely intact. And then I flip over to page 52. We've got in the right before the securing the perimeter section. This is in the section known as Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. It's paragraph 121. We've got an internal OPP email communication dated March the 28th, 2010, relating to a G8 G20 Public's Work Protection Act, but the OPP indicated they were not interested in exercising authority under this arcane legislation. Here is a bit of this email that the OPP superintendent wrote to his chief superintendent that day. He said he's familiar with the act, and it's a wartime piece of legislation that was revised and updated during the NDP era, but we have looked at it extensively in the context of public order. We have always believed we would save it for a critical time, as it would not likely stand up to a constitutional challenge the first time is used. Having said that, I do not believe we require its implementation for the G8. Understand, this is the OPP saying that they are against the Public's Work Protection Act being for the G8. So what we have here with the Public's Work Protection Act is the Toronto Police wanting this act for the city of Toronto, and they got the province to go along with it, even though the OPP weren't going along with it. And it was even more than that. You know, when you actually get into reading the reports, there is a longer list of the organizations that didn't want to go along with it. And those are organizations involved with the ISU, which is different than the SIU. SIU, Special Investigations Unit, has been searching, has been looking into the injuries. And the ISU is the Integrated Security Unit. Well, that was the amalgamation of all the forces for the G8, G20. And that might have been something I messed up on last week. I might have been saying the ISU, but I meant the SIU. But anyways, that's how these kind of acronyms you get confused here. But I was thinking, you know, why don't we throw it to the Ontario NDP leader, her reaction to this GHG20 secret law, the speech by the Ontario Ombudsman, the top watchdog, caught in the act. What does the NDP leader, Andrea Howarth, think about this GHG20 secret law?
Ombudsman confirmed what the people of the City of Toronto already knew, that Don McGuinty passed a law that he knew or should have known was illegal and unconstitutional. The McGuinty government not only went out of their way to avoid the democratic process, a democratic debate, they deliberately kept the facts about their illegal and unconstitutional measures from the public. When Dalton McGuinty invoked the Public Works Protection Act, there was no debate. There was no public discussion. And the facts were hidden from the people the government is supposed to represent. We'll continue to demand that full public inquiry. But first and foremost, the first thing that needs to happen this afternoon is that the Premier has to apologize to the people of this city. What happened was wrong. The Premier needs to simply admit it and apologize. The lack of participation by the Chief of Police is disturbing, there's no doubt. In fact, there's real concern around the tail wagging the dog, asking for the government to pass a regulation that gives the police more powers, and then the government simply acquiescing to that request. So there's a number of problems in that chain of events, and many people need to be held accountable. It's my job to make sure that the Premier is held accountable and that the minister in charge is held accountable, and that's certainly what we're going to continue to do.
You said that the tail wagged the dog. Do you mean that the provincial government kowtowed to the police?
That's certainly what this report indicates, that the request, I think what the Ombudsman said is that the request for the regulation can be traced directly back to the office of the Chief of Police of Toronto. Seems to me that that's exactly what happened, that the request was made and the government acquiesced. In a democracy, the government makes the laws and law enforcement enforces those laws. It's a bit backwards, if you ask me. And the last time I checked, we're actually a democracy here in the province of Ontario, and the government could have played this a lot differently than they did. In fact, other law enforcement agencies, other members of the Integrated Securities Unit didn't want to see this particular piece of legislation invoked, from my understanding of the reading of this report. They were not interested. They didn't think they needed any extra powers. Well, if the RCMP didn't think they needed any extra powers, and the OPP didn't think they needed any extra powers, and the military didn't think they needed any extra powers, why did the government of Ontario think that it was necessary?
Do you have any comments on the Ombudsman's recommendation number one on the idea of revising or replacing the Public Works Protection Act?
Well, the Ombudsman has indicated his pleasure that the government is actually going to implement the recommendations. We await the government's move on recommendation number one with relish.
Thank you.
Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. So that was Andrea Horwath, the NDP leader. How about we go right into the next man that spoke, Ontario PC leader Tim Hudak. The governing party of Ontario, the Liberals, were nowhere to be seen after the Ombudsman made this report. They weren't in the room, but here is the leader of the PC, Tim Hudak. What's his thoughts here on a secret law G20?
It's to change government. Now Ontario PC leader Tim Hudak will speak to the findings of the Ombudsman report.
Well, thank you very much, Garfield, my critic for public safety, community safety and security. A public inquiry into this mess is not needed because we all know there is one person who can answer all of the public questions today and immediately, and one person who owes it to families to come clean once and for all, and that's Premier McGuinty himself. Today I'm calling on the Premier to reveal all of the facts and end the cover-up.
So which that, of his this ministers is the words from the PC, the Ontario Progressive Conservative leader, Tim Hudak. He was in attendance, also in attendance to watch the Ombudsman report, was also PC party member Randy Hillier. I saw him there, and I know he was one of the people that wrote an editorial, strong editorial against this secret law and this, you know, the tyranny that reigned during the G20. So in terms of the progressive members of parliament were there, because Peter Cormos was also there in attendance from the NDP, who made a powerful speech about the G20. Here's a bit more words from Tim Hudak on this G20 secret law.
It is a dramatic failure of leadership and deceitful. We're talking about Dalton McGuinty's law. I mean, quite frankly, we're talking about Dalton McGuinty's secret law that the premier, don't tell me otherwise, knew had gone through cabinet. And don't tell me otherwise, the premier knew that the government of Ontario was conspiring to keep the facts buried from the general public. We actually had a premier of the province of Ontario and a minister of the Crown who brought forward an illegal and unconstitutional law.
Illegal, unconstitutional, secret law, and it was not published. This is some strong words. How about after I saw this Ontario Ombudsman and this political responses, after I walked out of Queen's Park yesterday, I saw one single protester protesting this G20 secret law, the police. Jefferson Rebu, here is an interview right here with one protester still out there protesting this G20 illegal actions. Why?
Daniel,
why?
Over here, we're here at Queen's Park, and we're in the front of Queen's Park, and I just heard the Ombudsman's report, and I found there's at least one protester out here still looking for a public inquiry here. Do you mind introducing yourself?
Hey, my name is Jefferson Rebu. I'm a criminology major from the University of Ottawa.
So what did you think? Why are you out here? You're holding up a sign that says, I demand accountability for the G20 police abuses public inquiry. Why are you out here?
Well, I've been actually out in front of the police station quite a bit lately. My fight is not against the police officers. That's one thing that people need to understand. I'm actually with the police. That's why I've studied police studies for many years. I think that a large percentage of police officers are great cops. A small percentages here are being protected. And obviously, I'm not sure why, but I have my ideas. Because of that, our police force is being unfairly stigmatized, and they're all looking bad. So I think we need an inquiry. We've got to get to the bottom of who did what, and you can't sweep it under the rug. Bill Blair can't come out and say, everything's fine, nothing happened, we reviewed the tapes, and we're exonerating all police officers because we can't identify them. Well, they had no problem identifying the black blocks with their facial recognition software that they paid millions and millions of dollars for. And anyhow, like as you can see, it's a very long story. I'm fighting the fight for people, for kids. I had a lot of kids out here that wanted to know about what democracy was today. And like I said, my message is positive. It's not negative. I believe in our government, and I believe in Canada. I think it's a great country, and I appreciate you know what you and your station do for us. So
yeah, thanks, man. We're in an interesting location to be talking about this, because this right here in Queen's Park was one of the scenes, epic scenes of the G20, where you know the whole park was supposed to be the free speech zone, and it was cleared out of people. Were you actually in Toronto during the G20? Did you see any of what was going on? Were you protesting?
That's the odd thing. I wasn't out here during the G20. I was out of town. During that weekend. Like I said, I've done a lot of protest after that, but like I said, it's all on YouTube. I mean, I'm talking with Sean Salvati, who's a very documented case. I read the Adam Nobody case. Like, everything is on YouTube, and these people need closure. You have to understand that these 1,000 people that were arrested suffered a lot of mental trauma, and that's a fact, what happened to them. This is a very terrible thing that was done to them, and if they get this closure, they can also, you know, I'm sure they can recover from that. Just like a lot of police officers, I believe, suffered a lot of mental trauma from the things that they seen, the atrocities they saw in those prison camps. And everything is recorded. Nobody's gotten to see these videos yet. I think a lot of these police officers are not getting a lot of support because it's something that they say, you know, you're being weak if you come along and say, hey, I've been affected by what I did or what I saw done to people. We're all good people. This is, like I said, this is a great country, Canada, and let's go back to our roots. You know, this law today with the Ombudsman, that's why I'm here today. This is a 60-year-old law passed after World War II. You know. It was just kind of thrown in there last second to us. So a lot of the population did not know, you know, what exactly was going on. And the law was clearly broken. And I'm really glad that Mr. Martin stepped up to the plate today and did what he did. I have a lot of respect for him and looking forward to seeing what stems from his report.
Yeah, for real. And the one thing that surprised me a bit was when he talked about the police chief Bill Blair's input. He mentioned that he had tried to request an interview with Bill Blair twice. He was denied both times, and Bill Blair didn't want to meet with him to talk with him about the secret law. Did that surprise you at all, that the chief is not, you know, talking with the ombudsman?
Well, no. What I find interesting is the SIU is the one that's doing the investigation. That's basically cops interviewing cops. Now, I didn't know, but I found it interesting that they don't have to give interviews. They always have to say this: yeah, I will interview and get information off as many people who are willing to speak to me. I think that's absolutely incredible. That's why if we get an inquiry, people will have to step up to the plate and talk, you know? And like I said, Bill Blair's made some mistakes with some of the comments he made. He's apologized for them, and I have a lot of respect for him for doing that. But he can make a big change here. He knows what happened. These police officers know what happened. Even though their badge numbers were ripped off and you couldn't identify them, people know what happened inside this police station. And I understand that you can't stand against each other. I have 100% respect for that. I've studied the protocol. But for Bill Blair to deny speaking to people, he has no problem with coming out in front of the media and displaying weapons that were used at the G20. One of them was a rubber sword that he picked up off some guy going to a D&D convention. I mean, stop making a farce of it, you know? The citizens here deserve some respect, and I'm demanding it, you know, and that's kind of where I'm at right now. So let's get a public inquiry and we'll get some answers, you know. We'll see the videotapes. The videotape's all there. There was actually a camera in front of the police station that was there when I started protesting, and all of a sudden it's not there anymore. So I find that very interesting that police station camera was taken down, you know. So anyhow, that's it's a long story, but we'll get there. And like I said, I might be one guy out here, but there's 60,000 people on Facebook on this G20 site protest. And there's a lot of people walking by me, giving me the thumbs up, honking for me. I'm getting a lot of support from people, and a lot of people are walking up and telling me their story of what happened to them. And the fact that they can't get justice, because like I said, police are investigating police. And I mean, where's that gonna get us? You know, it's incredible. Anyhow.
Real, yeah. Thanks a lot for your words today, December 2010. Calling for the public inquiry into the G20 police abuses. Word up. Word up.
Caught in the act. Word up. Word of mouth Wednesday. We're back here. We're just wrapping up our show for December the 8th. And we've got a few announcements here. Just want to announce the event screening taking place next Monday, December the 13th, 2010, Justice on Trial. It's the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's a 2010 documentary, 65-minute documentary, and it's taking place at the U of T Medical Sciences Auditorium. $5 donation requested next Monday evening, I believe 7 p.m., but just look out for it next Monday evening, December 13th. You'll hear some more. Also, the CKLN CRTC hearing is ongoing and continues tomorrow, so tune in, crtc.gc.ca. This has been the Word of Mouth Wednesday for our Caught in the Act report, G20 report, and we have got a, well, we got the, you know, CRTC hearing going on. We've got a, I'm just a guy sitting in the room. I got a Caught in the Act Ontario Ombudsman, Ontario Watchdog report. Look out for that. And, you know, look out for CKLN. Look out for Word of Mouth Wednesday. Look out for Cold Fusion Now. Look out for the G20 Public Inquiry. Look out for Toronto Truth Seekers. Look out for the next show on CKLN. Look out for the Blues Dr. Julie Hill back in the studio for her show, which is the Blue Remedy. So it's enough of the guest hosts. This is the Blues Dr. Julie Hill. We got to wish her a happy day for the return of the Blues Doctor. Stay tuned. Word up, word of mouth, word.